everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And you know, unless you really have that openness of your mind and curiosity to explore what's going on so you really can make informed decisions, you're so vulnerable to so many opinions and theories out there. So on this show and with my wonderful guest, we provide you with some information, some experiences that will at least let you ponder possibilities and from there really find the path that's right for you. I want to welcome all my new listeners to the show. If you haven't yet been over to my website, What Women Must Know, opt in there. You'll get the archive shows from all these great interviews I do. You'll also get some special reports. And also, I have a great Facebook page, What Women Must Know, where I post on a daily basis information that also is inspiring and educational. So lots of opportunity. Excuse me. Seem to have a little frog in my throat today. I just want to say that those are great resources, and I hope you take advantage of visiting my website and my Facebook page. So today we have a fantastic interview. I'm so excited. We're going to be talking with Dr. Anna Yassim, who is a board-certified psychiatrist with a private practice in New York City. And after completing programs at Stanford University, Yale Medical School, and NYU Psychiatric Residency Training Program, Anna went on to study Kabbalah, learn Buddhist meditation, and train under South American shaman and Indian gurus. She has helped over 1,000 people live happier, more meaningful lives, and she's just beginning because she has just written a wonderful book called Fulfilled, How the Science of Spirituality Can Help You Live a Happier, More Meaningful Life. And isn't that what we're all here to do? So it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Anna Yassim to the show. Hello, Anna.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you. I love what you're doing. I love your book. I love the message that you're bringing into the world and being such an example for people in your profession, in the traditional medical world, being that bridge that allows us to understand the deeper meaning in life while we use all the other great learnings and resources and skills that exist in that left brain side of our world, you know. So we have so much to talk about, and you have so much that you've been experiencing in your life and sharing in your book. And I thought maybe we can begin by just sharing a little bit with my listeners your journey and how did you go from such a traditionally trained medical doctor going to those elite schools that really drum the, you know, the best science into you? What happened that was your wake-up call?
Yes, absolutely, Cheryl. So my journey really started, you know, way back in the day, like you said, when I started my medical training and I was training to be a psychiatrist and a healer, learning all of the tools of Western medicine and traditional and modern psychology and psychiatry with which to heal my patients. And then as I was in the midst of my psychiatry residency, my own life hit a bump in the road, which I call my dark night of the soul. And in my personal life, I was dating this man and realized he would never be emotionally available to me in the way that I had hoped. And so there was this heartbreak. And at the same time, for the first time in my life, I was in academic trouble. And that made me feel like a total failure. And the coalescence of these two things brought about this darkness that I'd never experienced before and from which I couldn't really pull myself out despite all of these tools of psychology and psychiatry that I had under my belt. And I thought, well, you know what? This is a problem because here are these tools that I'm supposed to be using to help patients my whole life, and I can't even pull myself out of my own darkness. And that's when I started searching and said to myself, well, I need to figure out how to heal because if this is what I'm going to be doing with my life, first and foremost, I at least need to heal myself. And that's why I started looking for healing tools elsewhere. And that took me to ashrams in India and working with shaman in South Africa and South America and studying Kabbalah in Israel and in New York City and starting to really see the world from a different perspective. And in the midst of that, I learned so many different principles and tools for healing that Western medicine really didn't expose me to. And in the journey, my own darkness started to lift. And eventually, I was able to apply those same tools in my work with patients and ultimately in writing this book.
Such an interesting journey. So you had this dark night of the soul where you kind of lost yourself and then started this journey of awakening, because obviously you had a goal from a very early age to be involved in the healing arts, or to be a healer, through the traditional model, right, of medical school, and go on and find your specialty. But it sounds like that was not the real essence of healing that you eventually discovered.
Exactly, because what I realized in the journey was, just like you said, I had actually lost myself in this process of studying to be a traditional psychiatrist. And even though I'd learned all these things and gone to these top schools, what I really hadn't cultivated and really never was encouraged or had the tools to cultivate was my own sense of authenticity, who I really was at my core. And I felt, as I went through my journey, I realized I was disconnected really the whole time from my own soul. And it was in reconnecting to my soul. That's really what this whole journey was. It was a reconnection to my own soul, rediscovering my own essence, who I am. That really started helping me to heal, and then eventually was really instrumental in the work I have done with my own patients. I feel like first and foremost, what I help my patients to do is reconnect with their own authenticity, to realign with their soul and their soul's purpose.
Yeah, that's so interesting you say that, because when I was a psychotherapist for many years, I had a motto that I would share with my patients and people I was training, and that is, it's like you have to be that energy. You have to, it's who you are that heals people. It's who you are that allows others to resonate in a new way so they can be more open. So, you know, it's an interesting world, because psychiatrists are obviously given all the theories of the psyche. Of course, much of psychiatry, I would think, and you can help clarify that, is working with medicating people as opposed to helping them discover themselves. But until the person who assumes the role of psychiatrist is able to find themselves and heal themselves, I don't know how they really can be truly effective in helping other people to heal and find themselves.
Absolutely. And I believe it was Irvin Yalom, who's an existential psychiatrist and one of my role models, who said that you can only take your patients as far as you yourself have gone. Mm. The further you go as a person in terms of, right, you know, releasing your own self-sabotaging patterns, elevating your own consciousness, clearing your own darkness, the more you can help other people.
So you went from being a psychiatrist trained in that traditional medical model to working with the shaman, working with Buddhism and the teachers in India, who are the psychiatrists in their cultures and traditions.
Absolutely. And for many cultures, the priest is the psychiatrist of that culture. And I've certainly worked in many places, like in rural Ecuador, where when people have mental health issues or suffer from depression, pain, sadness, anxiety, they go to their priest. There aren't enough psychiatrists in the country for people to be able to one-on-one go to a psychiatrist regularly.
Yeah, and that, you know, underlying experience that people have when they're in the dark night of their souls or when they're lost and confused actually is a spiritual catalyst and leads to a spiritual awakening. I know that when I was in my last year of university, I fell into a really deep depression as well. And, you know, kind of wonder what it's all about, right? And in that space of really being confused and lost, and here I was about to leave university and all the protection that that world gives you, and not knowing where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do, I just felt really lost. And then And then I was in this funk for a while, and an awakening happened to me at one point. And I literally had what you would call a peak experience, where I just opened up to another reality, another spiritual truth that I had no idea even existed, which has really shaped and formulated the direction and purpose of my life ever since. So sometimes, and I would think always, those challenging times in our lives, if we can dig in deep and find resources and get support, can lead us to something very profound in our connection with ourselves.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the dark nights of the soul, as in your own experience that you just described, often are our greatest guides. It's only when you hit rock bottom that you can truly turn your life around and start to build your own self anew and take a whole new direction in your life. Because only then do you have the courage to say, you know what, things are so bad, I could do anything now. Like, I can let go of all the old structures that I had, because at this point, if I go any further down, life's really not worth living. So if I'm going to go back up again, I'm going to go back up as a different person, as a different entity, as, you know, a whole different being with new ideas and new ways that I want to live my life. And it's often, just like you said, the dark night of the soul that leads people to awaken in this beautiful way.
Because it really helps us to remember the greater purpose for which we're here, or maybe our purpose in life. You know, so many people in our culture, just in the nature of this three-dimensional reality we all have entered into, is we get so caught up in the busyness of life, we are missing the connection to our soul and our self that really gives us that meaning and fulfillment. So having said that, and with all your travels and learnings and experiences, what are some of the wisdoms that you share with your patients and can share with us today that can help people who are listening, who are struggling? It's a challenging time for many, many people right now, for a variety of reasons, whether it's an illness people are going through, or a relationship breakup, or financial breakup, or just kind of an existential crisis. What are some of the things that you share with people and you share in your book that are those guidelines that can help people, or maybe they're lifelines that can help people move through the challenging times they find themselves in?
Yes, and so I focus my work with patients around three primary principles, which are the three sections of my book. The first one is authenticity. The second one is soul correction. And the third one is connecting to part of something greater. So authenticity, like we talked about, is reconnecting with your soul, starting to, for the first time, feel your deep essence and align accordingly. And authenticity is who you are, separate from what everybody expects of you, what society expects of you, what mom and dad or your spouse or your children may expect of you. It's really what you feel in your soul is the primary contribution you're meant to make in this world, whether that be being a parent or being a creative person and contributing to the world of art or literature, or running a big company, or being a marathoner, is able to break world records, or just adding to the number of people in this world who lead peaceful existences through meditation, through spiritual practice. Whatever it is that is your purpose in sharing, that is your soul purpose. And it's so important to tap into your authenticity and align with that. The second part is soul correction. So your soul correction is that which your soul has come into this world to correct. And it's those self-sabotaging patterns we all have as human beings that come up in our life often over and over and over again, much to our dismay and chagrin, and despite our best efforts to try to change them. We all have soul corrections, and everyone has different soul corrections. So I speak about four primary ones in my book, and that includes harnessing your personal power, which basically means releasing victim mentality. Another one is transforming fears. Another one is releasing addictions, and not just addictions to drugs and alcohol, but addictions to anything that you may use as a crutch to fill a deep inner emptiness and therefore escape from yourself. And then the fourth one is improving your relationships, and there's all sorts of soul corrections in the relationship realm. And then the third part of my book is connecting to part of something greater. And in this part, I draw on some of the principles of quantum physics to explore topics like synchronicity and consciousness and interconnectedness and immortality, and to help people use these ideas to harness the power of spirituality in their own lives and to better understand how the world of science interacts with the world of spirit.
Well, that covers a lot. that's a great scope of experiences. Can you share with some of the stories you have in your book that help us to understand some of these principles and concepts and truths? Maybe share a couple of stories with your patients that can be examples
sure.
of what you're sharing.
Absolutely. So, some of the most powerful work that I've seen my patients be able to do is work having to do with forgiveness and being able to harness their own personal power by cultivating faith and forgiveness. This is a story of actually a dear friend of mine, and I have many patients who've experienced similar forgiveness, but probably not quite as extreme in capacity. So this friend is Jean-Baptiste, who runs the forgiveness program in Rwanda. So Jean-Baptiste was there during the genocide of 1994, when 500,000 people in Rwanda were essentially killed. And he was at home one day when a neighbor of his who was in the opposing tribe, it was the Hutus and the Tutsis, and the neighbor came and actually murdered his own mother. And the neighbor was a young boy his age, and his mother had essentially made food for the neighbor and, you know, all the boys in the neighborhood for their whole lives. And this young boy was put into this kill or be killed mentality, so he was forced to kill. And he went to jail for it. And Jean-Baptiste, understandably and very relatably, harbored anger and hatred in his heart for this young boy who killed his own mother. And it was 10 years later that he finally went to the jail cell of this man. And this man, at this point a man, thought that Jean-Baptiste was going to kill him. But instead, what Jean-Baptiste did was he forgave him, because he realized that the person who most benefits from forgiveness isn't the person being forgiven. It was actually Jean-Baptiste, because he didn't have to carry that pain and resentment in his heart any longer. And that was the most liberating and amazing day of Jean-Baptiste's life. And it was in doing so, his journey, that he was able to help so many other people in Rwanda with similar feelings forgive a lot of the perpetrators who had victimized them. So this is one story. And in my own practice, certainly few people have had people who've killed their own mothers, but there's been a lot of people who have had all sorts of deep pain and trauma and abuse and neglect, and helping them to cultivate forgiveness, and which is not a simple process. It actually takes a lot of time, and often it takes planting an initial seed and then really working around that seed to help it grow and become enriched, to really feel ready and to elevate your consciousness and open your heart to be able to forgive. But with my patients with whom we've gone through this process, it's really been life-changing. So that is something that is a form of harnessing personal power and one of the ways in which I've worked with some of these patients.
So with someone who is really dealing with a lot of hurt or wounds or anger or even hatred, do you start with an intention to find peace? Would that
Absolutely.
Be the first step?
Yes, and often to enable them to have a space to be heard, to enable their anger to actually be spoken about and explained, and to have some empathy for their own position. Because everybody who comes in, usually, if you are harboring a deep grudge, it's something that's been hurting you for so long, and often people don't even articulate and haven't had the opportunity to truly articulate and be empathized with for what it is that they've been carrying in their heart. And this is not to say that people should go about and blindly forgive everybody and to, you know, not have boundaries in their life for people who may have harmed them. forgiveness doesn't mean lack of boundaries. Often before you could forgive in the cases of abuse or neglect, it's actually so important to take the actions for a person to feel safe with their own boundaries to then be able to open themselves up to forgive. You have to feel safe before you could forgive.
Yes, it's a process because it's not an intellectual construct. You know, to forgive isn't something you think about doing, right? It's an experience that opens your heart. And when you feel that energy when you're dealing with anger and rage or hatred or grudge, you just feel your heart shutting down, and it's painful and ultimately will contribute to some form of imbalance in your body and health issue if you hold on to it long and hard enough. So we're hurting ourselves, quite literally. We're hurting ourselves when we hold on to feeling
precisely.
A victim.
Yes, so, precisely. Continue. Sorry about that.
No, go ahead. And then, go ahead. I just had another thought, but I'll wait until you finish. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to elaborate and say just how the mind and body are so connected, and often what exists in our mind shows up in our body in various forms. So frequently the pains that we experience in different body parts are really that. They're emotions that have been maybe swept under the rug and haven't been metabolized. And sometimes the metabolism of those powerful emotions actually releases physical pains. I've seen that in my practice over and over.
So can you elaborate a little bit about what that means to metabolize emotions?
Yes, yes. So I'll give you another example. So I have a lovely woman patient with whom I've been working now for 7 years. In the book, I title her Ilsa. And this is a no-nonsense woman who runs a nonprofit and who came to me 7 years ago having really, really deep stomach pains that she was forced to take time off for, and which she really felt were out of her control and she felt immobilized by. And this is not a woman who is out of control of her life. Quite the contrary. She's so in control in every single way. And she's a very conscientious employee, a wonderful daughter, a beautiful mother, does everything for everybody always, including for her profession, for her job. The person she often forgets to take care of was actually herself. And interestingly, it was those symptoms that she had that finally forced her and would actually force her on a regular basis every few months to take time off of work to take care of herself. And so, somehow or another, this woman who's become so good at being able to give of herself and sacrifice never really learned to take care of herself. And so as we were processing this, we started giving her permission to really take time for herself every day. And asked her the question, what would it mean to take radically good care of yourself? What if you started prioritizing self-care on par, if not even above, the care that you take of everybody else in your life? And interestingly, we realized that as she started to do this, which isn't an overnight process, it was actually over a couple years that this all happened, her symptoms started to go away. She no longer needed these pains in an effort to force her to take time off, because she was taking care of herself. She was taking the time that she needed now and didn't need. And that's often why pain is a source of guidance. And metabolizing the feelings and emotions underneath the physical pain we have could really guide us in the direction that we need to go psychologically and towards the changes we need to make in our lives.
So it's really learning how to listen to what's going on, rather than trying to immediately eliminate a pain or a problem, or at least to, if we're attempting on it, we all want relief when we're dealing with any physical discomfort or disease or illness. But along with that, we always have to be open to exploring what is driving this condition. Why is the body showing a dis-ease in some way or other?
Precisely, precisely, that every symptom we ever have is a call of our soul. It's a cry for help from our body, and it's only in heeding that cry that we could reconnect with ourselves, give our bodies and our souls what we need, and then the symptoms often will lift.
Well, so let's talk about addictions, because that's such a biggie. Most of us are addicted to something or other. It's just part of the unhealed soul, I would think, as you were saying. It's looking for that deeper connection, that we can be filled with that sense of connection, of who we are. So we're a very addictive culture. Maybe we're an addictive race. I'm not sure. But what are some of your suggestions for people who are dealing with addictions, whether it's to food or to alcohol or to drugs or to men or women or whatever the addiction may be, you know, caring, being codependent, giving too much of yourself, whatever the variety and flavor of your addiction may be, what are some of the guidelines that you share in your book and in your experience and your practice to help people begin to find that freedom from addiction?
Absolutely, and that's such an important question because you're right. There's so much addiction that's so prevalent in our culture, and it's always our efforts to fill a void that is hard to fill otherwise. On some level, all of us as human beings have a deep emptiness within ourselves, and we're trying to fill that emptiness all of our lives in different ways. There's constructive ways to fill the emptiness, like through positive relationships and work we find meaningful and connection to a God or the universe or a higher power, whatever it is that you believe is that thing that's a part of something greater. Or there's a lot of negative ways to fill that void as well. And that's where the addictions come in. So in my book, I talk about three categories of addiction. There's the categories that most people are familiar with, which is the drugs and alcohol category. And then there's also behavioral addictions, like you mentioned, like sex addictions and addictions to men or to women and addictions to eating, addictions to sleeping, all those things in excess could be addictions. And then there's those other addictions that people often don't think of as addictions, but often will serve a similar purpose. And that's the psychological addictions, addictions to status, money, materialism, to accomplishment, to perhaps workaholism and things of that nature. Workaholism probably is between psychological addiction and a behavioral addiction. And it's not to say that any of these psychological things in moderation aren't positive, because certainly a lot of them are positive in moderation. But it's when that becomes your purpose for being, and when that becomes how you define yourself, and when the more of it that you have, the emptier you end up feeling, that's when you know you've entered addiction territory. And so how do you end up shifting this? How do you get to the core of your being and start to fill your void in more constructive ways so you don't have to turn to destructive ways of filling the void through addiction? I think, you know, it's interesting because addiction is one of the two areas in medicine where the standard for medical treatment, one of the standards, is actually a spiritually based system, which is AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. Certainly there's agnostic AA and many non-spiritually based models for addiction as well, but somehow it's recognized in the medical community that being able to turn something like an addiction, which can completely rule your life, over to a higher power and ask for help for a higher power is quite empowering and really works from a medical standpoint. And the other place, by the way, in medicine where spirituality is very central is hospice care, when people make the transition from this life to the next. And in terms of specific tools that you asked, often it's about asking for help for this addiction to leave your life, to understand why it has been in your life for so long, to understand what it is that's driving you to fill the void in this way, and often to find replacement either behaviors or replacement addictions that temporarily can be much, much more constructive. For instance, sometimes people in the midst of an addiction will start coming to therapy and they'll start to feel addicted to therapy. And you can say, well, that sounds all wrong. But on the other hand, a therapy space is actually a very safe addiction. It's an addiction where they're here for the one purpose of helping them move beyond and grow as a person and evolve beyond. And oftentimes it's the temporary step to really helping people own their own power and take it back from whatever addictive substance they've been giving their power over to.
Yes, and I guess it's where when someone has arrived at the place where they know they need help, that they just can't control whatever the addictive behavior may be any longer. Something shifts inside themselves, and those moments of synchronicity come in where a random word or an invitation can just open up a level of freedom that they've been seeking. You know, I think that the greatest times of healing and transformation in our life and resolution of pain come in unexpected ways. They, in a sense, kind of out of the blue. We can't really anticipate what it's going to look like and how it's going to arrive when it does.
I happen to completely agree with that. I think synchronicity is such a powerful tool. And what is synchronicity? So synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence. It's a term coined by Carl Jung, a Swiss psychiatrist, who talked about the co-occurrence of two things which could appear random, but to which we ascribe particular meaning. And in that meaning often is a higher purpose. For instance, you think about someone and they call you. Or you haven't heard from someone in ages and you have a dream about that person. And the next day you're walking down the street and boom, you bump into that person. Is that a random coincidence? Or is that actually indicative of something meaningful? So people who see coincidence as a form of guidance or synchronicity as a form of guidance will often see a number of positive synchronicities or benign synchronicities in close proximity as the universe's way to guide you and say, you're on the right track, keep going. In contrast, if the synchronicities are negative, that every door you knock on shuts, nothing's working out, it's often the universe's way of telling you something's off, change course. It's not to say that you shouldn't persevere and try to break through, you know, barriers when they occur. But if you're open to guidance from the universe, you could be guided in all sorts of ways to heal from illness, to align with your purpose, if you're more open and accepting of the messages that you receive back.
So what are some of your favorite practical tools or strategies that you offer your patients and in your book that will let people start to tune into themselves? Because the answers, and I believe the answers and the path that leads us out of pain into a greater sense of harmony and balance and peace in our lives has to come when we initiate certain practices in our lives. So what are some of your recommendations that you offer your patients, that you do in your own life, that are foundational in supporting us on this journey back to ourselves?
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful question. And I would say probably the first thing is to identify your soul corrections. And the way that you can identify your soul correction is to ask, what is the greatest source of pain in my life? Something that keeps coming up over and over that I just can't seem to break through. And once you identify that, to realize that it's not a coincidence that this happens to be coming up over and over. This is the part of your soul and your life that you have come into this world essentially to correct and overcome. And in your pain also lies your greatest potential for growth. In your darkness lies your greatest potential for light. And so once you identify your soul correction, you could say, my own soul correction is, I'll share from my own life, is I kept drawing in emotionally unavailable men over and over and over. And I realized as I started going through my spiritual process, why did I keep drawing in these men? The reason was because there was a part of me that was emotionally unavailable. This is based on the spiritual principle that we don't draw into our lives what we want. We draw into our lives who we are. I was drawing in emotionally unavailable men because a part of me needed to open my own heart more to love, to finally be able to draw in a man who I truly could have a healthy, loving, and meaningful relationship with. And so I would say the first thing really is identifying your soul correction. What is your version of that? And then setting a very clear intention and asking for some guidance of, you know, I need to break through this. Now that I'm clear as to what it is I need to correct, universe, God, Mother Nature, whatever it is that's your something greater, ask for some help and guidance for the right people to come into your life, the right books to appear in your life, the right guidance in whatever form it's going to come into your life to give you the answers and tools to start to resolve that. That's number one. And I have a few others that I could share as well.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Yeah. So another thing is I think it's so important as part of authenticity to start to own all parts of you, even those parts, and especially those parts you feel might somehow be unlovable. This is the part of you that often is termed your shadow side, or the part that we will unconsciously disavow because we feel it's not okay. Somehow in childhood we were told that if you're angry, that's not okay, so don't ever be angry. Girls aren't angry. Or boys, you know, aren't supposed to cry or aren't supposed to be emotional or dependent, so don't do that. So we take that part of ourselves, push it aside, disavow it essentially, don't see it as a part of who we are, and then we end up projecting our own shadow side onto others. And then we get annoyed when others will show exactly that part of ourselves that we have unconsciously disavowed. So the way that you could know your shadow side is by asking, what is it that most annoys me about other people? Is it when other people are angry? Or when other people are appearing too needy, or when other people appear too confident, or appear cocky in some way. And how is that a reflection of a part of myself that I've pushed aside? Often, by identifying our shadow and starting to embrace and integrate that in our own life, we open ourselves up to what we once thought was darkness, but is just a part of being human, just like everything else. And when we can integrate this so-called darkness into our being, we're also able to start to own that much more of our light.
You know, that's such a profound truth. And the greatest challenge is there's part of our beingness that loves playing the victim role in life. You know, we get such satisfaction feeling how bad we've been done in, and the ability to encourage someone to take that first step to see that that person that we judge so harshly for, you know, the qualities, whatever they may be, is actually reflecting back to us a part of ourselves that we haven't acknowledged or own or recognized. Right there, that step, I think, is a breakthrough moment, don't you think? I mean, just the ability to kind of stop and be open to considering that that person may be a gift reflecting something to us that we need
absolutely.
To see.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's so powerful because in so many of our lives, we can see ourselves as a victim. And it's actually sometimes, you know, we feel this righteous indignation of feeling that we were wronged, we were a victim, but actually being a victim is the most disempowering mentality that we could take because what it means is we are privy to the whims of others. Like we don't have to take personal responsibility when we feel like we've been victimized. And one of the key elements in harnessing your own power, taking back your strength and power and living from a place of truth, really is giving up victim mentality and asking, in what parts of my life do I see myself as a victim? Who has victimized me? And how do I take responsibility for that? How do I take that back? How do I so it really ties to forgiveness because if we've seen ourselves as victims our whole life of an unjust world or of an imperfect childhood or of somebody neglecting us or abusing us, first of all, it's not to say that that pain wasn't real. Usually that pain is very real, but it often doesn't help us or it doesn't serve our advantage and it doesn't serve us in the long haul to continue to hold on to that victim mentality, to hold on to the fact that we were hurt and not move beyond that. There's nothing that can keep us more stuck.
Right. So where does the role of meditation come into helping to free us to be ourselves?
Yeah, so I think this is, you know, we're talking about all the ways in which you can harness personal power. And we've touched on a few of them, and that includes cultivating faith and forgiveness, relinquishing victim mentality. The other part, which I think is very, very central to meditation, is starting to own your thoughts and emotions, and also starting to embrace and cultivate mindfulness in your day. Because ultimately, what is it that undermines us in life? Often it comes down to the thoughts we think. And it's the thoughts that we might think of which we're often unaware. That could be thoughts of, I'm not worthy of being happy, or I don't deserve love, or I don't believe I screwed up again. I always screw up. Or I just know that that's not going to work out. Nothing ever works out for me. So those are just a few of the self-sabotaging thoughts that can go through our minds, often unconsciously, but could define so much of our world. And part of the goal of meditation is to start to become more aware of your thoughts and also to change your relationship with your thoughts. It's not to say there's anything wrong with those thoughts. What's wrong more is our attachment to those thoughts. And what meditation helps you to do is to let the thoughts move through you, for you to become aware of them, to acknowledge them, and then to let them go. And oftentimes then to ask yourself, okay, well, does that really serve me? Is there another kind of thought that could actually be much more useful to helping me be the best version of myself? What would that thought be? What if I started once in a blue moon experimenting thinking that thought, even if it's effortful and feels fake at first and is much more deliberate than, you know, my default pathway? But that's how change begins. And meditation is what enables people to change their relationship with thoughts and start to choose much more constructive thoughts to bring into their lives.
And that's backed up by science. And I think that's where neuroscience is really helpful for people to understand that meditation isn't just about sitting quiet for a few minutes and, you know, letting your mind wander or whatever people's thoughts are about meditation. When it's done with a proper technique, there are many, neuroscience is actually showing that we can rewire our brain. We can have new connections which create new perceptions of who we are and how we experience the world. So we're literally changing our brain and being able to have a new way of seeing ourselves and everything in our life.
Which is so incredibly powerful. And that's why some of these ideas are so cutting edge and yet only now starting to become backed by science and really shown and then integrated much more into traditional Western medicine, which is such a beautiful thing. And that's been shown, just like you said, with meditation. And it's also been shown with other forms of spirituality. It's been shown that having a spiritual practice, whatever that practice is, and whether or not somebody is part of a spiritual community or not, that is actually helpful with all forms of healing, including physical healing, psychological healing, emotional healing. People who go to church will often heal faster, more thoroughly. Prayer has been shown to help from illness, not just praying from oneself, but to, you know, pray for others. And yes, the studies are controversial and they haven't been 100% validated, but they're certainly suggesting that there is a power beyond us that helps us to become the best version of ourselves and to heal, often, you know, outside of our own consciousness. And we can tap into that. We all have the power to tap into that force.
Yeah, well, and which makes it so exciting, because it's one of those tools that gives us the ability to have a way out of not just our pain, but a way out of the illusion of who we are, so we can reconnect to the true power that's within us, which is waiting for all of us. I mean, it's kind of what our mission is here, for all of us. So I'm going to switch gears a bit, and I'm about to go off to Costa Rica and to spend some time at the Rhythmia Life Advancement Center, which is in Costa Rica, which I've talked about before on the show, where they have a week of spa experiences. So there's colonics and cleanses and massages, but the real purpose is to spend time with the traditional shaman there, who are conducting ceremonies, working with plant medicines to help us reconnect with our soul. So I was really curious. You spent some time in South America and even South Africa working with shaman, and I was just wondering what you learned from those experiences personally.
Yeah,
and then translated into your practice.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, people often wonder, what is shamanism anyways? And often a definition of shamanism that I really like is a person who works at the interface of these two worlds. They work in the physical world, but also in the upper world. And they're usually a spiritual person that's somehow guided to be able to go up and make changes in these so-called upper worlds that then affect our lives in the physical world. It's a very interesting idea, and it's so contrary to much of Western medicine, which is like, what are these upper worlds? Where do they exist? How are they scientifically validated and verified? And we don't have a lot of answers to those questions, yet there are whole societies and people who've been healed by shaman, many of whom I know and many of whom are my patients currently, and who will swear by this kind of work. And some people might then say, well, it's the placebo effect. You know, it's just their mind healing them. And it's interesting, you know, the placebo effect, it's a real effect. A placebo effect actually is healing. And if it is indeed the placebo effect, wonderful. Let it be the placebo effect. If the end result is healing, what a beautiful thing. Having worked with shaman myself, I don't think it's just the placebo effect. I think something very special and amazing happens if you have someone who's a gifted healer and able to work at the interface of these worlds. And, you know, shaman, in a way, are able to tap into your soul and get a sense of what it is that you need to heal. And then you might say, you know, we've been talking about souls all along. Well, what is this soul and how does somebody tap into it? And so my favorite definition of a soul is actually something that I got from a shaman with whom I worked in Mexico, Fernando Broca. And he says that a soul is composed of two parts. One is our essence and uniqueness and authenticity, that which is unique to us and essentially ours. The other part of the soul is what people often refer to when they say we're all one unified soul. It's the part of us that connects us to everybody and everything. So the soul has our uniqueness and our interconnectedness together in one essence. And it's the shaman that works to heal us by helping us reconnect with our soul and working in that realm.
Which is so powerful, and, you know, it is a very different paradigm than what we were brought up to believe to be true in our Western model of the world as it exists, but there are other models of reality that are quite amazing and can offer a profound healing, and certainly that has been my experience.
Likewise, and that's what I feel is one of my purposes here really is to take traditional Western medicine and psychiatry, which I learned in my training at Stanford and Yale and NYU, and to integrate that with these other modes of healing in a way that is evidence-based and scientific and really give people more integrative and holistic healing tools to be able to draw on both worlds, our traditional world, but also other worlds and other traditions of healing that have been around for thousands of years.
So how are you doing that? Are you doing workshops? Do you, how are you planning to take this body of knowledge from all these different fields and share it with people? I mean, you've written a book, so that's obviously a great starting point to share the information. What else are you doing or planning to do?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm in the process of planning some workshops at Kripalu, the Omega Center, the Open Center, and those are going to be happening soon. And in addition, I really work with my patients one-on-one. And everybody's different. And for everybody, spirituality has a totally different meaning. So spirituality isn't just religion or God, as many people think, but my definition of spirituality is anything that enables you to connect to part of something greater, whether it be God or religion, or whether it's Mother Nature, or a shared global purpose, or a collective consciousness, or even positive values that help elevate consciousness, such as trust and love and perseverance and hope. Whatever people's spirituality, I work in my practice with people to help draw on that and integrate traditional, medical tools when needed, including medication and obviously psychotherapy, but really to give people, you know, this other idea of healing and drawing on the healing tools used by various cultures. So in answer to your question, it starts really one by one, and then the next step was the book, and then the next step will indeed be healing workshops and speaking at medical schools, which I am doing right now as well.
That's great. So you're speaking at medical schools about these spiritual concepts and learnings that you've had and teachings?
Exactly, and really how to integrate it with Western medicine and the science base for it. And, you know, because science is the currency for Western medicine, and if anything is going to be integrated into the Western medical model, there needs to be a science base. And for a lot of things, there already have been legitimate studies that legitimize many of these ideas. But for other things, the studies are only just beginning. So it's really helping to educate students as to what's out there and the state of the science and the state of the research and what yet needs to be done.
I would imagine psychiatry must be your greatest challenge, Anna, because it's become... I don't know how many psychiatrists actually do therapy with patients like you're doing and in the realm that you're doing, but psychiatry has changed so much over the years and has become really an arm of, orthodox medicine and a lot of medications that are prescribed. Do you find there is some resistance to what you're talking about within your own profession?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because I think had I written this book maybe 15 years ago, there probably would be a lot more. But I feel very fortunate, actually, that two former presidents of the American Psychiatric Association, which is the governing organization of psychiatrists in our country, have strongly endorsed the book and stood behind it, which to me suggests that really these ideas, you know, the world's starting to become more open and ready for them, and that this really is the direction that ultimately medicine is heading.
Well, it's certainly a direction that we really need to go if we're going to create true healing and transformation and find the path to fulfillment. So that leads me to just let people know the title of your book, which is called Fulfilled, How the Science of Spirituality Can Help You Live a Happier, More Meaningful Life. And if you want to know more about Dr. Anna Yuseem's work, go to her website, which is Anna Yuseem, and that's Anna, A-N-N-A-Y-U-S-I-M, Yuseem.com. And she has a great website there with lots of information, and there's YouTube clips I've been looking at and interviews, so it's... A huge, huge world of experiences and wisdom from Dr. Anna Yuseem that's available for you if you'd like to learn more. So we have a couple of minutes left. Is there anything you want to just say before we conclude our conversation today, Anna?
Well, I think the main point of my book is that fulfillment is possible and that you could achieve it by taking slow baby steps in the direction of connecting to your soul. And in my book, I give readers the tools to do precisely that. And, you know, with that, I wish everybody all the best and hope that they take the steps they need to have ultimate fulfillment in their own lives.
Well, that's a wonderful and beautiful wish to offer everyone. I second that. And thank you, Dr. Anna Yuseem, for spending time with us and taking this time out of your busy practice. I encourage everyone to pick up a copy of Anna Yuseem's book, Fulfilled, because there is great wisdom there and answers that will help you finding your meaningful life and a happier life as well. So thank you, Dr. Anna Yuseem, for spending time with us today, and thank you to all my listeners for joining me for another opportunity to grow, heal, empower yourself, listening to What Women Must Know, and remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. So until next time, take care and have a great week. Bye for now.